So before we start this panel, I just want to acknowledge the the murder of my friend, Yaakov Dunn. He was my colleague for 4 years at CHAT and my friend ever since then. So I'm really quite grief-stricken tonight. Those of you who didn't know Yaakov, he had the singular gift of being able to understand what joy is from the inside out. He wasn't a person who simply feigned happiness. He really seemed to have had the gift of knowing how to love and be loved in a kind of effortless way, and he made everybody around him just feel that on a gut visceral level. And he was able to transmit that to every human being. I never saw him say a cross word about anybody ever in all the years that I knew him. He was 49 years old. He had four children. His parents were Holocaust survivors. And they had the singular misery of standing over their son's coffin yesterday. I also want to acknowledge, of course, the pain of the Schwartz family of Sharon, Massachusetts, who lost their 18-year-old son, Ezra, as well as the hundreds of other people in this past week around the world who lost their loved ones. And one of the things I wanted to say about Yaakov is that he was able to show what a rabbi can do in terms of his ability to inspire all those around him. And that, I think, is a good segue to what we're going to be talking about tonight. A rabbi today is in a very singular kind of position because there are multiple roles that a rabbi plays. A politician, a fundraiser, a teacher, a cheerleader, therapist, legal expert, orator, comforter, and so on. And as we all know, the internet and social media have massively affected how people think about rabbis. They're open to everybody's dissection. And it's quite a trick for a rabbi to be able to carry on his day-to-day duties, as well as handling the demands of his own family and his own life. So one of the things that interested me and the reason I thought of this panel a while ago is because in the Protestant community, research is now consistently finding that members of the clergy suffer from depression, from hypertension, at rates higher than most North Americans. Their use of antidepressants have risen, their life expectancy has fallen, and many silently despair of the demands of their job and secretly begin to burn out and worse. And of course, as we know from the Jewish community, the dark end of the spectrum is when a rabbi betrays his community's trust in a variety of ways, damaging, life-changing ways, from fraud to abuse of power, sexual misconduct, and so on. So in this discussion, I wanted to take a look at what I think is one of the most urgent issues facing Orthodox Judaism today, which is simply what makes for a good rabbi. How should rabbis be trained? What should be their chief function? Do we demand too much from them? And how and what ways can we monitor rabbis when they're in danger of falling, when stress is overwhelming them, when they seem to be diverting from appropriate behavior? How can we reach them before it is too late? And lastly, what kinds of protocols can congregations and professional rabbinic organizations implement to track and help the rabbi and also protect lay people? So it's my pleasure to introduce our speakers tonight in alphabetical order. Dr. Michelle Friedman received an MD from the NYU School of Medicine, completed advanced training at Columbia at the Psychoanalytic Center for Training and Research. She's the founder and director of the Pastoral Counseling Program at Yeshiva Chavrit Torah. In addition to her private practice and her role at YCT, she's also an assistant professor of clinical psychiatry at Mount Sinai Hospital in New York. Rabbi Daniel Karopkin, well known to Torontonians, is the rabbinic leader of Beit Avram Yosef, the Beit in Thornhill. He received his rabbinic ordination from Near Yisrael in Baltimore and his MA in Medieval Jewish and Islamic Thought from UCLA, as well as a Master of Science degree from the Johns Hopkins University School for Engineering at the Applied Physics Lab, and he's also the author of a new translation of the Kuzari. Rabbi Reuven Tradbergs is the director of the Israel Office of the Rabbinical Council of America. He received his BA from Carleton and his smicha from Yeshiva University. He served as the assistant rabbi of the Young Israel of Staten Island and the rabbi of Knesset Yisrael Synagogue in Birmingham before, of course, moving to Toronto and serving as the rabbi of Shaarei Torah from 1994 until he and his family made Aliyah in 2009. Rabbi Dr. Tzvi Hirsch Weinrib is the executive vice president emeritus of the Orthodox Union. He received his ordination from the Yaakov Yosef Yeshiva in New York. He served as the spiritual leader of the congregation Shomrei Emunah in Baltimore for 13 years. Rabbi Weinrib has a PhD in clinical psychology from the University of Maryland, and he served as a psychotherapist for mental health organizations for many years while also maintaining a private practice. Please welcome our speakers. I want to start with I guess the person who's still working, that's Rabbi Karapkin, as a pulpit rabbi. I'm wondering if, I said briefly in my introduction that it seems like a rabbi has so many hats to wear, and maybe I'm wondering if you think there's too many hats. You know, are they expected to be too many things all at the same time? And if they are, is it too much to expect, and does it affect their emotional life? Does it wear down on them to have to be all things to all people?
First of all, I'd like to say, I'll speak into the mic. First of all, I'd like to say welcome Shavuot Tov to everyone, and what an honor it is to be on the panel with these distinguished panelists. My first time meeting Dr. Friedman, but of course, my dear friends, Rabbi Weinrib and Rabbi Tradberks, and my teachers as well. And I'm honored to serve on the panel with you. And of course, Elliot, my dear friend, we've worked on this number of times already, and certainly our condolences and our feelings of grief are shared by all of us. So let's talk a little bit about the stresses of the job and the diversity of the job. The truth of the matter is that when you love what you do, it doesn't really matter what the stresses of the job are. You know, I was just speaking with a member of my shul who's a small business owner. He owns a kosher restaurant. And he was telling me a little bit about some of the stresses of the job. But at the same time, he told me, you know, Rabbi, I could very easily close this place and get a 9-to-5 job with some brokerage firm and make a lot more money. But he says, but I have a certain pride when I walk into the shop every day and I turn on the neon sign, and that makes me feel good. And that makes it all worthwhile. You know, we would hope that every rabbi who enters the pulpit or enters into Jewish education or whatever avenue they choose in the rabbinate chose the rabbinate for the best of reasons, not because it was the only thing available. That's very rare for that to happen and for that rabbi to succeed, but rather because they have a certain idealism, they have a certain love of Torah and of the Jewish people. And if that continues, which God willing it should, then you love the work that you do despite the stresses and despite the pressures. I was speaking to a younger rabbi not too long ago, and he was telling me that he knows exactly, you know, the stresses of a pulpit rabbi. It's 24/7, there's very little vacation. And I said, to be honest with you, I don't really view it that way. I said, if I was the CEO of a major corporation or if I was a small business owner, I would probably have to also wake up at 4 o'clock in the morning to go purchase the vegetables at the wholesale market and run the business myself. And that's what it is. I mean, when you're passionate about whatever business, whatever profession that you choose, you understand that the stresses are there and the pressures are there, and you prepare yourself for them. And if you are happy and genuinely feel that you're contributing something meaningful, then you don't view them as stresses. I don't know if I'm answering your question, Elliot, but I hope I am. Just don't tell people at the Bayit that I would do what I do for free, even if they didn't pay me. But I sometimes feel that way.
Notwithstanding, it strikes me that there's something different about picking up vegetables than there is about catering to your flock. So I'm wondering if we can have another kick at that. Surely there is something unique in the stresses that a rabbi would face and their family would face, perhaps in terms of having to be a role model 24 hours a day, being monitored, being watched for the way you act, what you say, what you think. Do you think there's something a little bit different about that as opposed to some other kind of profession?
Well, there's no question that there are unique challenges for someone who's a pulpit rabbi. A lot of it depends on the size of the congregation. Hi, Rabbi Strauchler. We commiserate all the time. A lot of it has to do with the size of the congregation, the nature of the constituency of the congregation, and every shteller, every pulpit is unique in that respect. Some of the psychological stresses that you talked about, there's no question that they exist. I can tell you that a good pulpit rabbi is an empath, and that's the reason why we got into this business, because we're very sensitive and we care. And so when something that just happened in Israel just happens, the rabbi has to emote, sometimes from the pulpit, in very dramatic ways, like I did this morning when I burst into tears, you know, reading an email that I had gotten from Israel. And so those are stressful because it creates a lot of emotional turmoil, but at the end it also creates catharsis as well. There are psychological pressures when you have to share in people's stresses in life because you sort of internalize whenever there's a patira, whenever there's a death, whenever there's a divorce or people are going through a crisis in life. Another thing that's very difficult to balance is creating private time, because a rabbi is supposed to be on call 24/7, and so sometimes you have to know how to properly balance the time that you set aside for your family versus your congregation, because there's a sense that a rabbi feels that any time that I'm spending with my family, I'm taking away from my flock, from my congregation. And so that has to be maneuvered carefully and properly, and sometimes from an objective party who tells you, no, rabbi, you got to take some time off, and you do need to spend some time with your family. And I think one of the, I wouldn't call it a stress, I would call, you know, one of the areas where I feel when I get disappointed is, and that I think that translates probably into stress, is when I see my expectation, and I know it's not a realistic expectation, is that the Torah is so amazing that the entire Jewish people are supposed to be a holy people that are doing everything right 100% of the time. Of course, that's not realistic. It's foolish to even expect it. But sometimes we do. We expect from people, observant people, to behave in a holy fashion. And sometimes when I see things happening in the community where people who are from sometimes behave in ways that are not holy, and they think that they're doing it in the name of religion, they think they're acting in the name of Judaism, and the exact opposite results through, whether it be Lashon Hara or harming people through their words or their actions, those things cause me a little bit of stress as well. And I have to sometimes speak to my wife and get a reality check that a lot of times there are distortions of Judaism, and part of my role as a rabbi is to try and clarify where there are distortions and try to dispel some of what I feel are mistakes made in the name of religion. The Muslims are not the only ones who are making tragic errors in the name of religion. Sometimes Jews do it too, although not to the same degree.
Rabbi Weinrib, Rabbi Kropman just talked about a number of the things that a good pulpit rabbi does, is empathic, corrects distortion, and so on. I'm wondering what you see as maybe the most important function of what a rabbi can do and is supposed to do above perhaps all others.
I think that there's no question about what that role is. And that role, of course, is the very meaning of the word rabbi. Rabbi is a teacher. So that's the role, that's the most important role for the rabbi. But having said that, defining what it means to teach and what the role of teacher encompasses is not so simple. And it's very complex, and it has become more complex in recent years with social media, with the various new degree of intensity of events in the world, such as the past few days. So what becomes important is for the rabbi to understand what his teaching role is. And increasingly, and almost universally nowadays, at least in the American rabbinate, teaching does not mean standing in front of a classroom and giving a lecture. That's not the kind of teaching that rabbis do. It's not time effective, it's not cost effective, and it usually is not as impactful as other modes of teaching. The good teacher is the person who can model a certain type of behavior. That's the most effective technique available to teachers. Not to show them what to do, but to be a certain kind of person. I often ask groups that I work with in various capacities, and I'm going to ask this group now to do just that, to think back and remember, who was your favorite teacher? Who is your best teacher? If you have more than one, matov. If you don't have any, that's understandable too. I'm not going to ask you to share this. It's not the kind of forum to do that. But when I think back of my favorite two or three teachers, I cannot remember a specific thing that they taught me. One was a rabbi, since passed away, named Rav Shmuel David Varshavshik, Zichrono Livracha. He was a Rosh Yeshiva in the yeshiva I attended. We learned Maseches Bava Basra with him. And I really do not remember anything specific that he taught me from Maseches Bava Basra. What he did teach me is a number of things. He taught me self-esteem, not just me, but the whole class. We were 18, 19 year olds when we were in his class. And he began to teach us, in using his terminology, what a Ben Torah is, how a Ben Torah is supposed to behave. Think of yourself as a Ben Torah. He taught us that we were capable of creating Chidushei Torah. Every Friday morning, a different one of us had to deliver what he called a chabura. We had to deliver a piece, a creative piece of mini lecture on some of the passages of Gemara that we were learning. And we weren't accustomed to do that, but he gave us tremendous self-confidence. It's very interesting. In my class especially, I went to school, the yeshiva in the Lower East Side of Manhattan, and we were a tough bunch of boys, and we all had nicknames. Someone in our class was Pepsi, another one was Duke, another one was Rocky. These were the names we called each other. I was called by a diminutive of my name. My name is Svi Hersh, but everyone then at least called me Heshy. And if, in my case, he would say to the class, Heshy? You can't call him Heshy. Their time will come when he'll be a great rabbi. And you're going to call him Heshy? You have to call him. He had a way of pronouncing his R's with a Litvisha R, Reish. So he would say, Medafim Rufen Svi Hersh, you know. And he would insist on that. You know. It's a small thing, but it's something that those are the kinds of things that I remember. I remember his sense of humor. I remember the stories he told. He was a refugee, a survivor of the Holocaust. He told us he was seeking refuge originally in Lithuania, then running to Poland and back to Lithuania, and then escaping eventually to Shanghai. And so told us stories about Shanghai, told us stories about his teachers, Rabbi Elchanan Wasserman, Rabbi Baruch Ber Leibovitz, etc. These are the things that I remember. And this is what he was. He was a person who was dressed impeccably, dignified, his beard always combed. His shoes always shined, etc. These are things that stand out. He was that type of a model. I had a seventh grade teacher in secular studies, Mr. Eugene Zeller. I always, for years, decades, I wondered whatever happened to him. And then I Googled him recently and found out that he's still alive and he's retired in South Florida, a very old man. I don't remember what he taught us, except that he did what teachers are supposed to do. You construct a system whereby people are rewarded for what they do, but the reward is itself a learning experience. So in other words, if we did our homework, he didn't give us candy. He read to us a story from, actually, he liked a book by William Saroyan called My Name is Aram, which is a story about Armenian refugees in, I forget the name of the city, Fresno, California. Relevant to today's, these days, discussions about America taking in, or Canada taking in refugees. But so he rewarded us by introducing us to different aspects of literature, humorous ones especially. But he too, what I remember, the ways he built our self-esteem, the ways he made us think of ourselves, in his case, not as B'nai Torah, but as readers, as young men who read, who read books, etc. And my interest in reading, which is an addiction at this point of my life, was something I picked up from him. So a rabbi has to learn how to do these kinds of things, not teach in a classroom manner, but teach through example. His sermons have to be not exhortatory, not musar in the usual sense, not preaching, but teaching. And there are ways to do that. And the ways have to do with using certain kinds of techniques, building a rapport with the audience, something a teacher has to know how to do, telling stories, making his sermons relevant to the needs, spiritual and physical needs of the congregation, etc. These days, and this is certainly not my field of expertise, I'm an old-fashioned guy, but he has to learn how to use social media for teaching. Social media, as we see, is the most powerful tool for teaching in the history of mankind. And we see how it can be used positively, and we see how it can be used negatively. But it's extremely powerful. I just read a psychological study of one of the more, quote, successful terrorists, successful at terrorism, and he was radicalized within a period of 10 days simply by being exposed to certain types of social media, YouTube, et cetera. So teaching means knowing the new techniques of teaching, the needs of the community, et cetera, et cetera. And this gets us to really what's the crux of the issue today of what happens when a rabbi disappoints or does things which are shameful, embarrassing, sinful, illegal, etc. That's the flip side of it. But the positive side of it is when a rabbi is successful at teaching and doing that through modeling his holiness is a high-sounding word, but that's what we're talking about. Modeling seriousness, modeling simcha shel mitzvah, modeling tolerance, modeling compassion, modeling the various values of Torah, modeling Torah study, modeling reflective contemplative prayer, modeling all the things that we value.
I mean, given what Rabbi Weinreb just said, I'm wondering, Dr. Friedman, if we're training rabbis the right way. How are they trained? You're right in there, involved in their training. What do you think we should be emphasizing in their training? And perhaps, if we're not doing what we should they be trained differently in some aspects?
Well, I know what I'm doing in my training of rabbis. I can't speak for all other seminaries or any other seminaries of other faith traditions. But I think I'm very grateful that I followed the people that I'm following, because I think what's been made clear is that these components of what a rabbi is about, and Rabbi Weinreb was talking about a great teacher, these things in a great teacher, in a great rabbi, they seem to flow naturally. And some people are particularly talented at this. And in the days before pastoral counseling programs or psychology programs, there were, of course, great teachers, great clergy, great mentors. But what we can do, what we want to do, is to break down these components so people can learn them. Because a teacher doesn't just happen. There are components to excellent teaching, and there are components to excellent clergy work. And that's the goal, I think, and certainly in the program that I founded and that I teach in, is to take young rabbis and to make them the best rabbis they can be. Some of them, are, as I said, are particularly talented in the human arts, in listening. They have a natural tendency to be compassionate. They understand what I'm talking about when I say active, non-judgmental, compassionate listening. And for other people, they're like, and they may be brilliant students in some ways, but they're extremely cerebral and they're not so connected from the head to the heart, and they need some work in that division. And so my goal is to make our rabbis really good first responders. I'm not trying to get them to be junior psychoanalysts or sort of adjunct therapists. I'm hoping that I want them to be good first responders, which is to mean that they understand that it's not only, of course it is, the challenges that people encounter, the tragedies, the life cycle events. All those moments are profoundly important for a rabbi. And one of our teachers said to me, if a rabbi doesn't do great divrei Torah, it's not okay. But if he doesn't do good bikur cholim, he's finished. That's really when people need rabbis in a very profound way, and a rabbi has to connect. But a rabbi also understands that when a young couple, or an old couple for that matter, come to him and they want to talk about him being their Masadar Kedushin to perform their wedding, that the way he talks to them, the way he counsels them, if he even counsels them at all, if he meets with them once, twice, three times to get a sense of what their understanding of their marriage is going to be about, what are their values, what are their challenges, what topics have they talked about, what haven't they talked about, that is going to set that's going to set the tone for their life together. That when a couple comes in or a parent comes in to talk about the choice of a kid's camp or to talk about a bar or bat mitzvah, the way the rabbi approaches that child and the parent is going to really make a difference in terms of that kid and that family's experience of Yiddishkeit. And that all of that is part of what I'm talking about in preparing these rabbis. And I think that they can understand the components of what is empathy, what is active, non-judgmental, compassionate listening. How do you recognize addiction? How do you recognize signs and symptoms of depression? How do you say to somebody, and I have my students practice this in role plays, they have to say, have you ever felt so bad that you thought of hurting yourself? Because if the rabbi doesn't ask that, who is going to? To get that person, the rabbi may be the gatekeeper to a mental health consult. The rabbi may be a gatekeeper to refer that person to a lawyer or to a domestic violence program or something like that. But if the rabbi doesn't know that that's something that's going on and or is scared, if the rabbi has the idea, oh, if I ask that question, I'm going to put that idea into somebody's head, which is a completely false notion. Nobody asking something, putting something out in the open, doesn't put an idea into somebody's head. It may help take that idea out of their head if it's properly approached. But people have to understand that. These maybe seem like simple ideas. Rabbi Weinreb was saying that a great teacher, he was talking about remembering great teachers. And I think great rabbis, you might not remember the drasha or the specific counseling, but what you remember, like with a great teacher, is the way you felt. You remember how you felt with a great teacher. You remember how you felt honored, how you felt exalted, how you felt like this guy believed in your future. And I think that is really incredibly important, and it needs to be explicit. And yeshivot and seminaries need to say this matters. You don't just learn it by osmosis. You know, maybe some people do, but a lot of people don't. And people need to have specific class time dedicated to this. They need to have support. They need to have supervision. This needs to be paid for. It's not the most expensive component, but it really needs dedicated time and some funding. And there's a lot of struggle, I think, in classical rabbinical education to say, yeah, this is worthwhile. We're going to not be studying Torah, and we're going to be studying psychology, and we're going to make time for a peer supervision group. We're going to go over cases. That really takes, and also, besides the time for this kind of enterprise, it also opens up time to talk about what may be complicated or contentious matters. So if you, for example, say, okay, we're going to talk about, we'll take a hot topic, Judaism and homosexuality. Well, what's going to come out of that conversation? People might be a little riled. They might be a little upset. So maybe in some ways, like people feel, well, let's just not have that conversation and we'll keep things calm. So I think that opening up the space, actually time-wise and energy, you know, energy-wise, opens up the possibility for conversations that go places. So there's, I think that there is a certain amount of resistance in traditional seminaries of all faith traditions, I might add, to have explicit training in pastoral counseling. I think what's happening more and more is that people are getting exposure to chaplaincy training, which is a very good start. If people spend time, you know, working in hospitals, that's very important. I think that's where most of the training is starting now.
I'd like to actually connect the dots here for a second. Given what you're saying, it sounds to me that there may be maybe out of sync. What you're saying are the, you know, key functions of the job and the actual components in terms of time spent on what they're actually learning for 3 or 4 years. I'm going to ask the three of you to think back in your rabbinic training.
Yeah.
Was it sort of more top-heavy on the learning and a little understressed on the other stuff, given that Dr. Friedman is actually saying that these are the most important things a rabbi can do?
When I went to yeshiva, it was very interesting. Obviously, 95% of the curriculum and the time was spent on traditional study. And the traditional, even the material that we studied was not directly relevant to the rabbinate. We were studying mesechtos that weren't relevant to practical rabbinics, etc. But the yeshiva that I went to, which is no longer in existence in the form that it was when I went to yeshiva there, some of the menahalim, and these were old school people, all of the teachers that I had in yeshiva were European trained, every case without exception were survivors through one drama or another of the Holocaust. But they did decide at some point to develop a series of lectures, discussions on what they called practical rabbinics. And we were exposed to some very, very interesting personalities, each of whom was a great teacher. None of them were professional teachers. One, who really is one of the heroes of American Judaism, American Jewish history, was Mr. Irving Bunim, Olav HaSholom. And he was really a master at delivering to us ways of, again, I'm coming back to teaching, informal teaching. He was not a teacher. He was a businessman, a philanthropist, a social activist, etc. But he was the innovator of studying something called Pirkei Avos on the Lawn. This is the lawn of the Pine View Hotel. I know this is a young audience and you don't remember the Pine View Hotel. I see a few people shaking their heads. The very notion of taking Torah out of the classroom and teaching in a natural setting on a lawn was revolutionary in his time. Like anything that's revolutionary or innovative, it was opposed as improper, not et cetera. But the informality, the notion that a rabbi could be informal, was a lesson that he taught. We also had a course in homiletics from Rabbi Harry Wahlberg, Olav HaSholom, who was the father of Mitchell Wahlberg and some other Wahlberg sons, who was a brilliant speaker, again, of the old school. But he taught us to think about sources for sermons. And of course, the only sources that we came into the class even thinking about as a source was Chumash and Rashi. Maybe a couple of Wertlach from some Wertel book or something. And he taught us to use the newspaper, secular books that we read, poetry that we read or wrote as a source for sermons. He taught me specifically, a sermon doesn't have to be a rabbi speaking to an audience. It can be the rabbi speaking to himself and role-playing different roles and playing out a dialogue, a technique that was way ahead of his time. I'm going back to the early 1960s. We also had the a year-long course with a man named Rabbi David Twersky. He was kind of neo-Hasidic, and he was the chaplain of what is today called the Maimonides Hospital in Borough Park. And he took us from the Yeshiva Beis Medrash, you know, once a week, to the hospital to kind of make rounds with him and things like that. It's interesting because when I sit here and think of things that I remember, so I remember generalities and I remember certain specifics. I can't repress one of the stories he told. He had a great sense of humor, and he taught us how to use humor. It's extremely important in all of the roles that Dr. Friedman was discussing, the roles that I'm discussing. A lot of rabbis become humorless over time. And using one's sense of humor is extremely important. So he gave us a class once on what do you say at a funeral of someone you don't know and never knew? Or what do you say at a funeral of someone who you know was a miscreant, not exactly an honorable Jew? What do you say about him? So he told us one story. He said he once had to deliver a eulogy at the funeral of the owner of El Producto Cigars. It was a company called El Producto Cigars. He came to the funeral, and, you know, here he is, he's a Hasidic rabbi, and he comes to the funeral home and he sees that the corpse is lying in an open coffin, which is one no-no, dressed in a tuxedo with a big cigar in his front pocket, because after all, this was his life symbol. So what is he going to say about this man? So I don't think he really did this, but this is what he said he did. So he said, I got up there and said, I'm looking at Mr. So-and-so lying there, looking so handsome and polished, and well-dressed, and the cigar in his pocket. I understand the cigar, but I can't help but wondering, where are the matches? And then I realized, where he's going, he's not going to need matches. So... and of course he said to us, you know, I hope you guys will never do anything like that. But sometimes humor, and even this kind of severe negative humor, in this case, literally black humor, can be very, very helpful.
So numerous studies show that one of the key factors in clergy burnout is the feeling of a lack of gratitude on the part of their flock.
Sorry, Elliot.
You want to cut in?
I just wanted to make one observation. I believe that most yeshivas today do not do formal clergy training with, what Rabbi Weinrib is discussing. I also had a smattering of, which was... oratory skills, teaching skills, but the skills that Dr. Friedman is discussing are generally, you know, pastoral skills, psychological skills. Those are generally not taught in yeshiva, and I would venture to say that there are a couple of reasons for that. Number one, most of our yeshivas today are in the business of making the highest quality B'nai Torah that they possibly can. They're not in the business of producing rabbanim, because realistically, only a very small percentage of the graduates of any yeshiva are going to go into the pulpit, are going to go into the rabbinate. So it's really not the core sort of mission statement, certainly not the yeshiva that I went to, Neri Yisrael, probably certainly not in Lakewood and many other major yeshivas. That's not part of the core mission statement of the yeshivas to turn you into a polished, refined pulpit rabbi. Perhaps it should be. I'm not making a judgment statement, but that historically has not been the objective. I do believe, however, that there should be a program, even if you're not going to Chovevei Torah or YU, which also has, from what I've given to understand, has more hands-on pastoral skills available to its graduates. Any Ben Torah, who's going to go into the rabbinate, should not make the mistake that I made, which was just going into the rabbinate and trying it out by the seat of your pants. Thank God I have a wonderful Rebbetzin, and I've had over 25 years of experience, so I've learned a lot of tricks of the trade by speaking to very wise people and getting a lot of guidance. But it was not done through a formal professional training program, and I lament that. I wish that I had more training.
I just want to add quickly, that's true. Rabbi Kropotkin is true, but what's also true in the yeshivos and types of yeshivas that you mentioned, that there are also programs available to those students who are going into the rabbinate. Programs that are made available through RCA, through Torah Mesorah, through Young Israel, training programs which do more and more focus, not as intensely as Dr. Freeman's program, but do focus on pastoral skills and other non-Talmudic, non-halachic, non-just Torah study kinds of rabbinic skills.
So I'm just going to turn things around here and talk about the idea that many studies show that clergy of all denominations, Christian, Jewish, lament the lack of gratitude that they're shown. And studies show that the reason that they're not shown gratitude is because congregants see this as part of their job description. In other words, the kind of constant concern and attention that the rabbi pays to each and every one of his congregants or her congregants is just part of what they should do and not something that merits special gratitude. So I want to ask you, Rabbi Tradberg, two questions. Number one, to comment on this potential lack of appreciation, and also, in general, what do you think that lay people or congregants understand or appreciate the least about the life of a rabbi?
You say the life of the rabbi or the wife of the rabbi?
Yeah.
I think people don't appreciate how much the wives of the rabbis, not only what the wives of the rabbis do for the congregants, but what the wives of the rabbis do for their husbands. So I want to recognize my wife. I think, Elliot, the question that you ask, which is, what do people least appreciate about, the question is actually totally wrong. Because how in the world do we know what the congregants are thinking about us? I think the biggest source of stress, I can say this now because I'm out of the business for 6 years already. It took me 2 years to decompress and to rediscover who I was, whether I'm the person I am or the job that I was doing. I think the rabbis become totally alienated from themselves. No, I shouldn't say that. That was my experience. My experience was that I assumed a role, and then that became who I was, which is problematic. I think the other points about training, I went to Yeshiva University and took supplementary rabbinics and never went, because I really wanted to be a rabbi because I liked learning Torah, and I felt that being a rabbi would be able to teach. And I had no sense of the complexity of the job that we were getting into. Yeshiva University ran a seminar a couple of years after, I think 2 years after I got smicha, in which people who were in their first or second positions came back to Yeshiva University, maybe 20 guys, and all said, "What in the world are we doing? We have no idea how to prepare sermons. We have no idea how to visit the sick." I remember, I don't know if I should say this. I remember being with a very experienced rabbi, I asked him, I said, what do you say to people when you visit them when they're dying? Just like walk me through that. I have no idea what to do when I walk in the room. So that's just in terms of rabbinic training, it would be really good for rabbis after they're on their job to take a sabbatical for a month or two or three, go back and do this training. And now we really know what we don't know and to really learn it. And I think, but I want to get back to what you asked. One of the biggest sources of stress for me in the rabbinate was I had no idea what people's expectations were, and I always thought to myself, did I visit them enough? Was that a meaningful visit? Did I meet their expectations? When I went to a shiva, was I there enough? Is that what they wanted from me? When I would speak publicly, I would think, did I inspire enough? Did I not do that? And I was always wondering, is there a groundswell of dissatisfaction in how I'm doing my job? I don't know, I'm not hearing from anyone. And I do want to acknowledge Murray. So Murray was a member of our board, and Murray Newman. And Murray said to the board, or me, I don't remember, this has nothing to do with job assessment, nothing else. I want to meet with you once every week or two, just quietly, just the two of us, and let's just talk about your job, what you're thinking, whatever. Never went back to the board. It wasn't a purpose. It was a purpose for me to talk with someone, and it was extremely valuable. It was an eye-opener for me to be able to share my inadequacies, what I felt was my concerns about the job. And so I think that that's one of the things that I think is a source of stress, not knowing expectations and meeting expectations. And I think that communities could do a better job helping rabbis, like my son Eli is working in a consulting firm. So at the end of every year, this time of year, they have a job review. He meets with whoever he meets with, and they go over his work for the year, and Joyce did it with her teachers, do a self-assessment. No one does it with the rabbi because you can't be honest with the rabbi. The only time the rabbi gets feedback is when people are mad or disappointed, and then there's no context. You don't, and then you deflect it, and you say, well, that person's crazy. And that's another thing, too. There are a lot of crazy people. Rabbis have to deal, we have to deal with a lot of people who have mental illness. We can't, you know, Ed Pakus is here. I used to ask him, I don't know what the label is for this person, but I can describe them to you. And they're draining my energy. They're just too, it's too much. What do I do with this person? So I think there's a tremendous need to have a foil, a communication, a job review that's not where the job's on the line, because then that's tense and a different thing, but just a communication where rabbis can know where they're meeting expectations, where not, in order to do the job better than they're doing it.
I feel like there should be some sort of special bracha that you get to say that you actually survived all of those years in the rabbinate now, you know.
I say it every day.
Dr. Friedman, I just wanted to pick up on something that Rabbi Traberg's just said, which is this feeling kind of being in the dark. And I'm wondering whether you talk about this with some of your trainees.
Yes, and Rabbi Traberg's brought up a number of really important points, which is, you know, you can teach a lot in the classroom, but until people get out there and are in the real, you can support them and supervise when they're doing internships, but until they're out there in their pulpit, in their hillel, in their school, in their shul, whatever the organization, the institutional sense that they're working in, it's a whole different ballgame. And I think support in the field is absolutely critical. So I think like a round of applause for the Murrays out there who really volunteer not to criticize, but to say, I'm your ad hoc, I'm your go-to, I'm your support person. I'm going to speak to you honestly. And I think every rabbi needs to find more than one is a good idea because you get diverse opinions. But I just want to give some thoughts about this because I get calls from our musmachim and other rabbis out there in the field who call in to say, help me with this. And I think that's great. Now, just yesterday here in Toronto, the UJA of Toronto sponsored a get-together with rabbis from the Toronto area area across the denominations. I got together with about 10, 12 rabbis. They sent me in snippets of challenging case vignettes with all identifying information changed, so nobody knew who they were talking about. But, and I've done this in other communities in New York and Montreal and Nashville, and I do this at Chovevei all the time. But it's amazing, this sense of loyalty and confidentiality and support. Some of these people obviously knew each other, some didn't. But they all have, no matter what denomination, I would actually say no matter what religion actually, the same kinds of challenges being rabbis in the field. Dealing with disappointment, dealing with feeling like, what expectations do I have, and have I really met them? Did I visit it enough? There's three deaths in the community this week. I'm exhausted. You know, feeling of whatever the challenges happen to be. And that the end of that group yesterday, we spent 2 hours together, and people didn't want to leave. And I think that kind of peer support that's facilitated maybe by a mental health professional or somebody is a fabulous support. And it's really not expensive and easy to do. Every city has a surplus of people who want to help the rabbis and support them. I think communities should pay for supervision for their rabbis so they could go to somebody professional, and not, it's not like, you know, a pro bono kind of thing, to review difficult cases, etc., things like that. But I think support of rabbis in the field is absolutely critical. I'll give you one example of an issue that I hear about, and I'm sure that the people on the panel have experienced this. You worked in a community for X number of years. You're leaving for whatever reason. You think you've done a really good job. Maybe the community's too small and there isn't a school for your kids, or maybe there's another opportunity or whatever. And all of a sudden, the community that you're leaving, that you've served so diligently, seems to be turning on you because you're leaving them. And people don't like to be left. And that whole challenge of rabbis moving and separating from the community is really painful, and something that they deserve to have support with. So I think that support for our rabbis in the field is absolutely critical and needs to be done on a regular basis. And it's very easy to do.
You just comment on that. I don't think you really want the when the rabbi leaves to have too big a celebration.
So could we formalize some of this? In other words, should there be something like, I know they do this in the Protestant clergy where the congregation pays for, say, a paid retreat or sabbatical for the rabbi for everything from a month to 6 months to a year. And do you think that should be formalized in terms of Jewish congregation practice?
I think that's a fabulous investment in your rabbi if you do it. And I think it should be done because I think it's really not much, and it goes a long way. By the way, I just want to say about the pastoral counseling program that I run at Chovevei, the whole thing is 2.5 hours a week. We're not talking about a day a week. We're talking about 2.5 hours a week.
Just want to mention something else. There was a program which J.J. Schachter ran for many years, I think still does, of what he called Yarche Kala. Mm-hmm. She's a wonderful scholar and was a very successful rabbi, and his wife is a psychotherapist, very fine psychotherapist. So he would invite 35 rabbis to, when he was in Boston, he did it there twice a year. We went four times, and he had a new group. So at one of these sessions, Dr. Schachter, his wife, led a session where we talked about difficult balabatim, you know, difficult cases. So no one could really come up with any cases. No, but in the... In the course of the discussion, she said, well, hold on a second. In order for you to discuss this case, why don't you back up and tell me, why did you go into the rabbinate? Was it because you liked the power? Was it because you felt you were so good that you could influence people to become closer to the Torah? Is it like this messianic concept that you have of yourself? Was it control of people? Was it because you wanted to help people?
Was it all of the above? Yeah.
So I thought that was so interesting for me personally, because it was not, after being in the rabbinate for, you know, 15 or 20 years, I'd never asked myself that. And it's hard to answer too. But I think that there's a lot of ego in rabbis and power and control and superiority. And these are things we have to understand about ourselves in order to be honest about how it is that we're dealing with other people as well.
As a graduate of someone who still goes occasionally to Rabbi and Dr. Schachter's programs, I can tell you that it's, for me, a very useful way of getting a reality check, because it's a way of connecting with many of my colleagues, mm-hmm. and we're able to share stories, war battle stories, share battle scars, and we're also able to commiserate and listen to Dr. Schachter talk about some of these issues. Listen, I think we also need to talk about different stages of a rabbi's career. Certainly, a young rabbi is going to need a lot more tutelage and guidance than a rabbi who's been in the field for a number of decades. And a congregation has to recognize what stage in his career a rabbi is and work with him accordingly.
So I'm actually going to challenge that idea. From the studies that were done in Christian clergy, it was actually the ministers who'd been ministering for a long time that were actually at risk of falling the deepest. They'd been spending many years, the accumulation of the kinds of stresses that have been articulated here had built up over time. There was also the sense that they had that they were in senior positions and therefore, you know, they did not consult. In fact, it was seen as their job to mentor others as opposed to having someone to go to. So I'm not actually sure that the proposition you're articulating here is accurate in terms of the real field experience of the rabbinate. And I actually did want to move to the question of what happens when rabbis begin to fall and ask you all to think about the following set of questions. First of all, what do you think should be a congregation's first move when they suspect that something is amiss with their rabbi? And this is obviously a complicated question. How do they balance off needing to protect themselves, meaning as a congregation, with obviously not wanting to unfairly or prematurely damage the rabbi's reputation permanently if, in fact, the issues turn out to be unfounded?
Okay, what I'm hearing from everyone so far is both a diagnosis and at least a direction for a cure. I'm hearing a lot of we versus they. It's the rabbi and it's the congregation, as if these were two parties, an employer or a set or a group of employers and an employee. A group of listeners and a speaker, a group of students and a teacher. However, I think that a successful rabbi and a successful congregation are the ones who can create a sense that we're not adversaries, but not even in two different roles. We're working on the same mission. I got that in my own pulpit most when we were doing a fundraising campaign for a new building. Because then it was in that setting that I was working the closest mm-hmm. with the members of the shul, when it wasn't me versus them. If anything, we were all on the same team. If we were angry at someone, we were angry together at those stingy guys who weren't coming across with the pledge that we thought they should make and that type of thing. For me, I disliked fundraising then and dislike it now, but that process was one where I got the sense of we're all on the same team and working together. And it was clear to the group that was doing the fundraising that I had certain skills, but I had certain limitations that other people could. So it was a much more cooperative effort. And I think that's really the desideratum, the goal that we have to work to in all the work that we're doing. It's not I happen to have been blessed with an especially excellent congregation in every way. And one of the ways was that I had people in the shul who just in terms of standard rabbinic learning knew how to learn far better than I. I had members of my shul, the entire team that did the translation, the Art Scroll translation of the Talmud. All of those Kollel students were members of my shul. And I could see easily falling into the trap of either trying to show, no, I am smarter than you, or feeling intimidated, etc., or trying to give very, very scholarly drushos, even though they were only a small fraction of the shul, just to impress them, etc., etc. But from the very beginning, I enlisted them in the work of the shul in very way so that we were seen as being part of the team. It meant for me giving up some of my high and mighty role, but for them it meant accepting me in a certain role. But in terms of Elliot, in terms of your question, the answer to that question, it can't be an answer written in the guidebook. It's got to be an answer that depends upon the nature of the relationship between the rabbi and the congregation. And in some of the more dramatic cases that we've witnessed, or that I or other people here who deal with rabbis who crossed red lines, it seems to me, almost without exception, that these rabbis were stuck in the model of it's the rabbi and it's the congregation. So then when the rabbi misbehaved or is suspected of misbehaving, the congregation is stuck, what do we do? And the last thing we're going to do is talk to the rabbi because we don't want to tip him off, et cetera, et cetera. In a shul where the rabbi and the congregation are more in a cooperative relationship, then the answer to your question becomes a very different one. In the most dramatic case that's come across lately, the case in Washington, D.C., my understanding is that the president of the shul, when she first became aware of the, became suspicious, she did not go to the rabbi and confront him. She went immediately to the police. And that turned out to be, had she gone to the rabbi, he would have just covered everything up and we would never be upset by that particular scandal. But because she went to the police, et cetera. But there are other scenarios that I can imagine where it would be proper to first go to the rabbi to talk it over with him, or to talk it over with other people in the shul, or to talk it over with people who knew the rabbi better or knew him in a different capacity, or to speak to some other rabbi, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So a lot depends upon this getting out of the rabbi versus the congregation kind of a model. It's not easy, but I think it can be done, at least to a great degree, when people are well-intentioned and are really trying to work on these kinds of things.
I appreciate what Rabbi Weinrib just said about the fleshing out this whole thing about the dangers of the rabbi being this kind of superior imperial authority and that kind of power dynamic and people being frightened. At the same time, I think it's vitally important that all shuls and institutions do have guidelines. There need to be, you don't know what your red lines are unless there's a line drawn. So how do you say that this isn't, what's an infraction? What's weird behavior? Criminal behavior, there's laws on the books, but what's a behavior unbecoming a rabbi unless there's guidelines? And similarly, guidelines for behavior and who do you go to when there is a perceived problem? And people have called me up from different communities and there's perceived problems, and very often a tremendous mess is made because there's a panic and there's a whole, or there's something isn't done or too much is done or the wrong people are spoken to and people's reputations are, I'm talking about people who are making allegations and those against, about whom the allegations are made. These are very, very delicate situations. So I think that there need to be guidelines and there need to be protocols. Who do you go to? The shul president in the Washington case really was a very powerful and capable. I was asked to come to D.C. a month after that whole thing broke as a scholar in residence to talk about it from the pastoral point of view. And they did a remarkable job in containing and approaching a really ravaging situation. So I think it is absolutely critical that there are guidelines for appropriate behavior, and there's also policies, like what do you do when you're worried about something? Who do you go to? What do you do about the job of the person, the teacher, the rabbi, the chazan, whoever it is that is accused of or somebody is alleging some kind of misconduct of whatever kind?
See, there's a problem with these kinds of...
I just want to make a couple comments. First of all, I think that what Elliot said from the beginning, I read that same study from Duke University, in which it said that there is this was the theory, is that there's a physiological change in the brain as a result of stress that occurs over time. And so that if a person starts out with the idealism of what Rabbi Korobkin had and still has, but over time, there are things that change. A number of these scandals, as striking, is that it's not men in their 30s, it's men in their 50s and 60s. So maybe there's something changed over time as a result of stress and the job, and things which they would never have dreamed of when they were 30 and they went into the rabbinate somehow become things they're willing to do when they're in their 50s or 60s. And I think that one of the challenges, and Rabbi Weinreb knows this well, is that there is a tendency for rabbis to self-protect. And so if the person that you're going to with the issue is other rabbis, to bring them in, we do have a tendency to give each other more latitude than an independent third party would in assessing situations. And I think in all the protocols that would be put into place for shuls and for institutions, it's got to be an arm's length reporting process. I will say also that at the RCA, we're working now on a code of conduct for rabbis, a full document covering financial things, appropriate conduct in counseling situations, congregant rabbi things, and it's very, very difficult. It's very difficult to set very clear guidelines as to what's appropriate and what is inappropriate, and what you do as a result of someone who goes over those lines.
Yeah, I think when we start talking about guidelines, like the Friedman's type of guidelines, or yours, Rabbi Tradberg's, there's a lesson to be learned, which psychology has learned only in the past 20, 25 years, but which goes back in our tradition, way back. The trend is to focus on the negative, to focus on the misbehavior, to develop guidelines for what to do when things go wrong, et cetera, et cetera. What pays off much more in the long run is to take a positive approach. And if you're going to write guidelines about the ideal behavior of a shul. Write guidelines about how rabbis and shuls can work together cooperatively. Do not even begin to look at what happens when you go wrong until you really describe what a model shul relationship is, what a model rabbi congregation relationship is, how to achieve that type of relationship, et cetera, et cetera. That's the lesson of positive psychology, and that's the lesson of every Jewish approach to human behavior that I can think of, whether it's the Nevi'im, or whether it's Muslim movement or Hasidus. And a lot has to go into just what that is. My experience with misbehaving rabbis and congregations is that no two of them are even remotely similar. They are so different depending upon the dynamics of the congregation, the dynamics of the relationship of the rabbi to the congregation, the rabbi's specific difficulties, et cetera, et cetera. They're so highly individualized that it's almost impossible to imagine what type of guidelines you could make to cover the whole range of cases.
Rabbi Weinreb, if I can just jump in. I think you're absolutely right. And by the way, people should know that Rabbi Weinreb probably has the most experience of any rabbi in North America in dealing with scandals in the rabbinate, as his position as the emeritus executive vice president of the OU.
And the wise man.
Yeah, and a wise man on top of that.
Oh boy, I can imagine what's coming now from these two guys.
You know, No.
I was trained long ago in psychology school, not rabbinic school, that when you listen to someone speak, wait for them to say but,
and then begin to listen.
No.
There is no but here. There is no but here. The only thing I would just like to interject is, it's true that every case is unique, but in retrospect, there is a tzad hashava. There's what we call in the Talmudic parlance, you know, a commonality between them all. I think, and then Rabbi Weinrib, please correct me because you do have more knowledge. I believe that in all of the recent cases that I know of, the warning signs were there.
Yes.
The warning signs were there in retrospect. And I think that the tzad hashava in all of these rabbinic scandals is a sense of hubris and a sense of perhaps a lack of humility and a sense of the sort of the God factor in a lot of these rabbanim. And I agree with what Dr. Malamud said. As we get older and we become more entrenched within our pulpits, we feel a greater sense of power. We feel a greater sense of we've arrived, you know, we're the, you know, we're the cat's pajamas or whatever, you know, and we're like, we really think that we've, you know, we're it. And if unless a rabbi has people to give him reality checks on a regular basis, whether it's the Rebbetzin, whether it's members of the board that he can speak to, whether he's working with a team of rabbis or his therapist, you know, the first thing that a congregation has to look for are the warning signs. Is the rabbi behaving arrogantly? Is he constantly being self-congratulatory? Is he making himself the center of everything that happens in everyone's lives? I remember my, you know, listening to a rabbi, every time I would hear him speak at a life cycle event, the focus would be on his relationship with the family. Not talking about the milas, not talking about the wonderful things and qualities of the bar mitzvah boy or of the chassan and kala, but something that happened between him and the bal simcha. That's a warning sign. That's a warning sign that the rabbi has lost his orientation and lost his focus, and now everything in life, everything in the world is about him. And that's what a congregation has to be wary of.
I just want to mention, we've had discussions, Rabbi Weinrib and also Dr. Friedman, about prevention of these terrible tragedies where rabbis self-destruct. In other words, what Rabbi Karapkin just said is you can see warning signs, but I know rabbis who have outsized egos. Mm-hmm. So what am I supposed to do about that? You know, we have you know, forums where people post things and discuss things, and you look at them and you say, this has the ingredients for a person who's going to self-destruct. So what do I do? What do you do about that? So you go to the shul and you say, do you know that your rabbi is an outsized ego? I don't, you know, that's the very elusive thing about this. You know, shuls, just like spouses with each other, are willing to overlook some weaknesses because there's other strengths. So in prevention, I said to Mark Dratch recently, should the following person be found in 2 years to be a headline, you and I would not be surprised. But I'm not sure that right now we know that they're involved in, you know, you also know, just one last thing, that if 8% of the population are alcoholics and 8% are drug addicts and 8% are involved in gambling and 8% of sexual inappropriate behavior, and you add it all up, so do you think that's absent amongst the rabbis? So you know that that's going on, and how what to do to help people who are in trouble before they become a headline. And it's very, the thing is hard. It's hard to get on top of that.
There too, I start to think of, okay, so what's the remedy? That's definitely the case. What's the remedy for it? And here's where we get to something that's extremely important and where rabbinic organizations have a role to play. And that is decreasing the isolation of the rabbi from his peers, either through the type of thing that Rabbi J.J. Schachter does or through some other kind of mechanism. The interesting thing, during the years that I was in Baltimore, we had that in an extremely heterogeneous group of rabbis. I mean, ranging from Hasidic to Yeshivish to modern Orthodox, et cetera, et cetera. It wasn't a peer therapy group. It wasn't a sensitivity training group or anything like that. But it was there was a lot of working together on community issues, community problems, not necessarily psychologically loaded ones, but they gave us a context within which we knew about each other, we could talk to each other, et cetera, and where some of us to some of the others of us could make the kind of approach of, hey, you know, you're really whatever. And that's something, it's something to work toward in communities. And nowadays, you know, even a rabbi working in some isolated community wherever is not isolated. You know, you can get on Skype and you can have that type of a group of peers working together as easily as you can do, maybe more easily than face to face. And that's something that's desirable and possible, and a kind of a, if we're going to work on guidelines, let's work on guidelines that will help rabbis do that, because a lot of this has to do with isolation. Mm-hmm. And the rabbis who are misbehaving fall into several categories, not just the inflated ego category. It's also the extremely depressed category. Sometimes those are the same. That's different sides of a coin. But I think if there is a tzad hashava, to use Rabbi Karapkin's terminology, that tzad hashava is isolation. The rabbi is working in isolation. And that's sometimes difficult to define, because a rabbi could say, I'm isolated. I have meetings all day with 30,000 people, and I'm teaching, I'm in a classroom, et cetera, et cetera. But if you look at it in terms of his inner self, his inner self is isolated, compartmentalized, away from everyone. I'm not even going to go into his relationship with his own family, but just in terms of his relationship with the rest of the community, community of rabbis and community of lay leaders.
It strikes me that there's two different things that are being talked about here, and there's also something a little bit problematic to me about what you're saying. There's the rabbi who would get help if there was a kind of peer support group. I would venture to say that Rabbi Barry Freundel would not have benefited from a peer support group. I don't think that would have changed the fundamental dysfunctional issues that caused him to do the damage that he did. I think that some people would benefit from it, but I also see something very problematic about peer support, because one has to think in sort of the complex terms of what would happen with rabbis admitting to other rabbis that they do certain things, and there you're getting into things like a certain defensiveness, a certain feeling of resistance, because maybe fear of job loss, if I admit that this is what I do, I seem weak if this is what I do, so I wouldn't see that necessarily as a cure-all. And I'm also wondering, you know, you alluded to it sort of casually, the rabbi's therapist, but I'm sort of wondering if we, if part of the protocol is to get rabbis more into, almost as a part of job description, to have some sort of mental health available for them and be encouraged to enter into therapy.
Yeah, I mean, there's obviously no cure-all for this issue, and I have to look at various approaches. The kind of peer group that I envision is not a gut-spilling or even as much of a self-disclosing peer group. It's just people working together on emotionally neutral issues, work issues, to a sufficient extent so that they trust each other to a certain degree, and so that they have entrees one to another and can have confidences. I mean, the image that I have, when I was in the practice of psychology, I use a lot of imagery. The image that I have of a successful rabbi is one specific episode in Moshe Rabbeinu's life. And it's interesting because he is the leader par excellence, although he too had his flaws. But he had a father-in-law who we'd listen to sometimes. But the image is the Aharon v'chur tomchu v'yadov. Moshe Rabbeinu, when the Jews were at war with Amalek, he stood up on a hilltop and held his hands up in prayer, but he didn't hold his hands up alone. He had Aaron and Hur holding up his hands. And Aaron was his model. Aaron was his older brother, and Hur was his much, much inferior subordinate. But he had what, in terms of Pirkei Avos, was Aseh Lecha Rav Ukaneh Lecha Chaver. He had someone to look up to, some Rebbe, older person, therapist, whatever you want to call it, but someone who was in a somewhat spiritually superior position to him, or he felt that way. And it's fascinating that the Mefarshim, when they speak about Aseh Lecha Rav, deal with the question of, suppose you're the biggest and most knowledgeable Rav, how can you fulfill the Aseh Lecha Rav? And we're told by Mefarshim, classical Mefarshim, doesn't matter. The person can be less of a Talmud Chacham than you. You must have a Rav. You must have someone who you treat as your superior. That's one part piece of the prescription. And the other is Kenei Lecha Chaver. You have to have a peer group. There has to be people at your level or below your level that you associate with. But there are concrete ways, specific ways. It doesn't have to be guidelines and rules. And any rabbi who's out there, the best advice you can give to a fledgling rabbi, a rabbi in training, is don't let yourself get isolated. Speak to the rabbi down the block. Keep in touch with your teachers in the yeshiva or seminary or wherever. And just teach him that simple rule, a six-word rule from Pirkei Avos. You don't have to be a great lamdan. Aseh Lecha Rav, Kenei Lecha Chaver. These are extremely powerful kinds of things. And there are ways to facilitate that. We have ways in our community to facilitate that type of thing. And by the way, speaking of social media, one of the advantages of social media is that there are tremendously powerful ways of Kenei Lecha Rav, Aseh Lecha Chaver. You can have a peer group with someone in Saskatchewan. It's not a problem. If he's your age and someone that you're amenable to. As we seek for remedies, and there's no cure-all, obviously. Human failure, no one ever invented a cure-all for human frailties. But part of the answer to these problems is creating healthy social relationships to push out the unhealthy social relationships that we're all prone to and would sometimes get us into big trouble.
Agreed.
The people want to ask questions from the floor? I just want to look around. We're gonna bring the mic around, and people can ask questions from the floor. Strikes me that by the time we reach Bamidbar, Moshe Rabbeinu may have be suffering from rabbinic stress and a little bit of burnout, because the job seems to be getting to him.
Let me also point out that locally here, a group of Orthodox Rabbanim get together about once every three or four months and have lunch together. Rabbi Rosenberg joins us and other Rabbanim. And actually, Rabbi Tradbergs, you'll be gratified to know that it's your successor, Rabbi Kanofsky, who really is one of the major forces that organizes those luncheons. And they're very helpful.
So if you have a question, if you could go and stand at the mic there so we could get it on tape. Great.
It's okay this way? Yes. My name is Jules Sulzbach. I'm originally from Holland, although I've been in Canada for 25 years. I grew up in a big shul where the rabbi was put on a pedestal so high that you couldn't see him. But his task was quite limited. It was about to pask and shilas, the drop of milk in the meat, etc. The stress he was under was quite limited. He had to solve very practical questions, very practical problems, and in this way...
I'm going to ask you to ask a question, please.
Yeah. Couldn't it be that the task of the rabbi has become much more complex over the course of the years, and that the congregation is much less willing to give him the benefit of the doubt? He is the one who has to go solve all problems, and if he doesn't succeed, they'll... Trash him out.
There's no question that over the years, especially in North America, the role of the pulpit rabbi has changed. And thank you for your question. I was just had a guest over Shabbos who heard Chief Rabbi Lau, make a comment saying that he had visited a Rav in Baltimore a few years ago and couldn't believe, I think it's your successor, Rabbi Weinreb, at Shomrei, couldn't believe.
It wasn't me.
No, it was, I think, after your time. He said he couldn't believe the amount of work that this fellow was doing from morning till night. Shiurim, counseling, Bikur Cholim, Shiva houses, leading minyanim. In other words, the North American pulpit rabbi has a much wider responsibility than perhaps the European model and certainly the model in Eretz Yisrael. I remember seeing a movie of a couple of years ago called The Serious Man. Did anyone see that movie?
Oh, wow, yeah.
It was, yeah. What was it, the Coen brothers?
Yes, yes.
And there's this scene about the guy, the main character who goes in, needs to speak to the rabbi. And he goes to the shul and goes to the secretary, and the door is open. He sees the rabbi just sitting there reading a sefer, and he says, "I need to speak to the rabbi." And she says, "He's busy." Closes the door. He says, "But there's no one in there." "He's thinking." You know, that was, the rabbi used to be busy with thinking, and you respected that. And today we ridicule that because, you know, no shul wants a rabbi that has to open up a sefer to prepare a shir. We want a rabbi who knows everything already. So, but there's no question that a lot of times there are things that we have to triage. A pulpit rabbi certainly has to triage and address different responsibilities and make decisions of where am I going to prioritize my time. And a lot of times it's the right decision, and a lot of times it ends up in retrospect being the wrong decision.
Thank you. Rabbi Korobkin, it's the cat's meow. To get back to your earlier thing. My question is for, sorry, I felt
there's nothing about pajamas in there?
No, sorry. Although I loved your interpretation.
Okay.
I just want to ask a question to Rabbi Weinreb. My gut sense is one of the things that came out here from Dr. Friedman earlier was about supervision. I'm married to someone who's a psychiatrist as well, who has benefited greatly from going for supervision for herself. It seems like a great idea in the sense of getting, you know, it's not the old boys club going, I'm not trying to be cynical, going to the rabbis, it's completely private. And my impression, Rabbi, is you seem resistant to that idea, and I wanted you to comment on that, please.
Not only I'm not resistant to the idea, but that's what I do most of the time. I supervise rabbis who request supervision. And in some cases, it's once in a long time type of thing. And in some cases, it's a regular, ongoing, you know, biweekly session that we have, usually by phone. I was trained in clinical psychological supervision, so I use some of those tools in the supervision I do for the rabbinate. But that's not unusual. It's usually these days not formalized, but it's become much more formalized, where rabbis will go to a senior rabbi or a peer who is more respected or more knowledgeable, more experienced or whatever, on a regular basis. No, I wasn't suggesting, I'm not sure where you got the idea, I was resistant to that. In my career, I had a different career path than most people because I came to the rabbinate, the pulpit rabbinate, much, much later in life than most rabbis do, after having several careers, actually, in psychology and in education. But I remember from the very beginning that really, literally, the night that the shul announced the election and that I won the election and I was going to become the rabbi of the shul, receiving supervision from a rabbi in the community who came over to the house and said to me, "Mazel tov, and I'm here for you." He gave me words of encouragement and said, you know, please, let's talk about it. And I live in a yeshiva community. I lived in a yeshiva community in Baltimore, in Eretz Yisrael, the Rosh Yeshiva there, or Neuberger, et cetera, were always available to the rabbis in the community, whether or not they were students of that yeshiva, whether or not they had the same ideology, hashkafa, place on the spectrum, whatever, to offer supervision. They may not have called it supervision, but it was supervision, and it's one of the ways to go. It's one of the ways, along with peer group, one of the ways to diminish and break down that isolation.
See, to me, what the crux of the matter is, now that I'm hearing you, is the question of the rabbi voluntarily seeking out help, or the rabbi actually being placed in a structure where it's not voluntary, where I know that in certain analytic training, it's not voluntary. Like, you have to have a training analysis, and you have to undergo psychoanalysis. And so I'm just concerned that if we leave it up to the rabbi to get supervision, some of them will, and a lot of them won't. And I'm wondering if we actually have to institute, on the basis of the kinds of rabbinic misconduct that we have been seeing, that it's actually not optional anymore. That you actually have to, as part of your job description, be formally under somebody's supervision, that every rabbi in a pulpit, in a position where they're dealing with congregants and with children, must be made to go into under a supervisory capacity. That seems to me the crux of the
matter. You want a frank response? It's a great idea, but it will never happen.
And why not?
Because there is no professional structure that can enforce it. You can't pass a law or enact a rule where you can't enforce it. I mean, that's aleph beis in dealing with people. There's no organization that had no at this point in time. That maybe things will change. I don't know. I don't see them changing. I think there are a zillion different rabbinic groups. None of them have any influence. No yeshiva really disciplines its graduates once they leave. The structures that are there in other professions are simply not there in the rabbinate. So it's a good idea. It's a great idea. And you could write all the guidelines you want, et cetera, but it will not happen. The people who will seek supervision will be precisely the ones who don't need it.
It's ironic, isn't it, that in Orthodox Judaism today, we don't have a unifying body that can make those kinds of enforcements. Rabbi Gorman is here, who's a friend of mine, a conservative colleague, and they have much more structure. You know, I was just speaking to someone about the law, the rules about giving a get. And if a rabbi gives a get in an unapproved fashion, right, he's going to be censured and he'll be stripped of his pulpit. We don't have that in Orthodox Judaism. First of all, there's so many different shades of orthodoxy that one shul and one yeshiva is not going to recognize the authority of another. And even the most encompassing body, the RCA, doesn't have full authority, not all pulpit rabbis. And Toronto is a great example. Probably a minority of the rabbis who serve shuls are members of the RCA.
Yeah. There's a wise man in my former shul in Baltimore who had a very, very keen sociological observation, but he phrased it in terms of the proverbial man from Mars, or person from Mars. And the person from Mars came down to, let's say, to the United States, or to the United States and Canada, and he said, oh, there's this religion called Judaism. Tell me about it. So the person he met was a Jewish person. He said, well, there are three different denominations. There's the Reform, and there's the Conservative, and the Orthodox. Oh, very interesting. What do they each believe? So he said, well, Reform and Conservative pretty much believe that it's a matter of choice, and there's a lot of flexibility and different opinions, and you can follow this way, follow that way. And the Orthodox are very rigid. There's one way and only one way, et cetera, et cetera. So he said, oh, then the Reform and Conservative must have many, many different rabbinic groups and many, many different seminaries, et cetera, because there's so many different opinions. And the Orthodox, they must have one rabbinic organization and one yeshiva. And lo and behold, the opposite is true. And the opposite is true, which tells you that there's something, it's a mistake that we make in so many ways when we think that orthodoxy is ortho. It's not ortho. It's much, much more complex and diverse and heterogeneous than conservative jury or reform jury. It's fascinating. That's the way it should be. But that translates when it comes to disciplinaries among rabbis, when we're consulted in the OU by a search committee in a shul to make recommendations about a rabbi, et cetera, et cetera. Do our recommendations have any clout whatsoever? Does any search committee and any shul that I know of can hire any rabbi they want as long as they get a majority of the board, and their rabbi can be from any shiva, any school, any background, or none. It sometimes happens. And as far as disciplining, there's just the mechanisms just don't exist. If you want to suggest that we come out of this evening and try to do it, you know, it's a dream, but it's like Don Quixote and the windmills. It's not going to happen.
Mashiach will be here.
I just want to respond to that. I think that Rabbi Weinrib, your position at the OU and my position at the RCA, Dr. Friedman's position at Chovevei, Rabbi Korobkin as a member of the, an officer of the RCA. I think that even if there's not going to be coercive disciplinary measures that can be sanctioned against shuls or rabbis that don't have this, let's say, psychotherapy or supervision for rabbis, I think we still have an obligation, if we think that this is the right thing to do, I'm not saying that we control the Orthodox rabbinate, but we have a, we have big voices. I think it is something that we have to pursue. I think it is something that we have to put on the agenda. And I think there is, there can be positive progress made in that area, even if it falls short of complete supervision. And let me just, last thing, there are a lot of really good rabbis. I, whenever we have discussions like this, you know, there are rabbis who are in trouble and in difficulty, but there are many, many, the vast majority, who are honest, sincere, lishma, trying to do what they think is right, and doing what they think is right, and inspiring people, wonderful teachers, and wonderful role models. And there are many, many. Every time I go to the RCA convention, meet new young rabbis, it's very inspiring. There are lots of wonderful rabbis out there. We have to deal with the difficulties and the challenges, but we shouldn't be pessimistic. I think we should be optimistic.
Last question.
So I thank you, Rabbi Chadbricks. There are a lot of great rabbis, but there are a lot of great rabbis, but this session is titled Rabbis at Risk. And so my question is about accountability. We're talking about supervision and forcing rabbis to go to counseling or whatever. My question is, how do we then hold them accountable? With the Rabbi Freundel case, he wouldn't have been arrested if that woman wouldn't have gone straight to the police. And they had specific, I mean, right away, they had specific protocols. And it was suggested here that rabbis often protect each other. So other than going to the police when it involves a rabbi committing a criminal act, what are the ways that we can hold them accountable? Pope Francis right now is talking about, and Rabbi Korobkin, you recently wrote an article on, you know, do we need a pope, a Jewish pope? And he's talking about instituting a situation where if bishops allow priests to commit criminal acts, they're going to be held accountable. So if rabbis either cover up for each other or continue to act in ways which we cannot supervise them, how do we then hold them accountable?
Maybe we can send all the rabbis to Pope Francis and see how it works.
let me just respond to that briefly. I think you're absolutely right. I think there are efforts being made at the Orthodox Union and the RCA together to try and address this. It's to come up with a mechanism as to how shuls who have concerns with the rabbi address those is elusive. It's not so easy. But you're right. There has to be an arm's length, professional, independent body to investigate that shuls can go to. There will be a formal process that will not just deflect the issues. You're right. It is something we have to do, even if it is elusive.
Yeah. The one model for that at the Orthodox Union we had now some time ago. Our own scandal, and as a result of that, we responded in a variety of ways in terms of standards, in terms of supervision, in terms of special training, better hiring, better education, etc. But we also have an ombudsman process, not one ombudsman, but several ombudspersons with a hotline to call. These people are specially trained. They're hired because they were trained to begin with, and they undergo consistent training, et cetera, et cetera. And it's interesting over the years. I'm very closely involved with this process. And over the years, the number of calls have decreased, decreased sometimes to none in months. I don't know why that is, because in almost all the literature we have for parents, and et cetera, there's a paragraph that says, if you suspect this or that or the other thing, here's whom to call, what number to call, et cetera. It's been a very, very, very helpful process. That's the good news. The bad news is that, of course, these are employees of ours. So if we find them misbehaving, and we have all sorts of recourse, including disciplining them, firing them, or whatever, et cetera, in the rabbinic structure, and this is what's so frustrating, At this point in time, there really is no such power. And this is what, and then read Rabbi Karapkin's article. You don't read mine, I don't read yours.
How do you know I don't read yours?
But, of course, but Judaism in general, and Orthodox Judaism for sure, there is no pope, and there is no hierarchy, and there is no system of that sort. I personally don't think it's desirable. I think that the kind of freedom and flexibility that we have and have had, and the rabbinic autonomy, et cetera, have been models, and we've had, obviously, very serious disappointments, et cetera. But Rabbi Trabrax was quite right. By and large, the system works. It doesn't work perfectly, but we're human beings. And by and large, the rabbis that I know quite a few of them, are really model rabbis and do try their best and are sincere and honest and et cetera, et cetera.
We've certainly come a long way, but I think I would not be saying anything shocking if I told you that even in Toronto, there are still rabbis, unfortunately, who believe that when there is a scandal in the community, you don't go to the authorities. You tell it to the Rav, and the Rav takes care of it, shtilahet, and we let the Rabbonim deal with it. And unfortunately, this has had tragic, really, really tragic repercussions in the past. I don't have to tell many in the community who are in the audience about it. But we have come a long way in many of the circles of Orthodoxy. And I can only encourage the people in the audience and whoever's listening, you can be part of the solution as well. If you see something happening that needs to be reported to the authorities and you feel that a cover-up is being perpetrated, then it's your responsibility to take action.
And I, for one, am shocked to hear that about the Toronto Rabbinate. I can't believe my ears. We're going to have more questions afterwards, but you can address them privately. For now, I'm going to wrap it up publicly.
Sure.
I want to thank you all for coming, and please give these speakers a warm hand.